picture 31, the hammer and the anvil. And the topic here is church and state. The prayer comes from Stephen Langton. Stephen Langton was an Englishman who served as Archbishop of Canterbury. Before he was appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, he spent about 20 years in Paris as a student and as a teacher. He was a first-class scholar, but I expect that, although hardly anybody knows this about Stephen Langton, I expect that he is most famous because most remembered because he is the man that divided the Bible into chapters. Until Stephen Langton, whole books of the Bible would be copied without any chapter divisions. And the chapter divisions of Stephen Langton were taken over when printing began. Thus, every copy of the Bible has become a memorial to this Archbishop of Canterbury. He also wrote some commentaries on the Bible, and he wrote a poem directed to the Holy Spirit called The Golden Sequence. And the prayer that I want to use now, which is a wonderful prayer, which emphasizes God's grace, comes from Stephen Langton and The Golden Sequence. Let's pray. Our strength renew, on our dryness pour thy dew. Wash the stains of guilt away, bend the stubborn heart and will. Melt the frozen, warm the chill, guide the steps that go astray. Amen. There was no issue in the Middle Ages more vexing to people than the issue of authority. Where does ultimate authority, ultimate power reside? Does it reside in the church, or does it reside in the state? Does it reside in Paris, or does it reside in Rome, to put it another way? That struggle between the church and the state goes all the way back to the time of Constantine. But in the Middle Ages, it has some very dramatic episodes. Rather than trying to talk theoretically about all of this history, church-state struggle, as to who is going to be superior, I would like to illustrate it in describing the struggle between Thomas Becket and Henry II. The views that were common in the Middle Ages were two. One could be drawn this way. Of course, this is the view the Pope is going to advocate. God is above all things, but under God there is the Pope, and under the Pope the King, and under the King and the Pope the people. So the Pope has authority not only in the church, but in the state as well. Not everybody agreed with that, namely the kings. And another way of thinking about ultimate authority was this: there is God, and under God there is the King, and under the King, the Pope and the Church, and under both the King and the Pope, the people. So that sets up the conflict between church and state. Of course, in the Middle Ages, there's no division of church and state like we have today. So the question was always there: who is going to have the last say about something? Of course, at times it really did not matter But when, say, the policy of a king conflicted with the will of a pope, then there was a showdown and a conflict which resulted in much struggle and unhappiness in the whole period of the Middle Ages. Let's illustrate that struggle from this episode in English history. Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Henry II, the King of England. And for this, we go back to the 12th century. You can see the dates of Becket, 1120 to 1170. Thomas Becket at first was the Chancellor, the King's right-hand man, and a very good one. And King Henry and Chancellor Thomas Becket were good friends. They liked each other, and they trusted each other. And Becket did everything he could to serve his king. For 8 brilliant years, he was the Chancellor under Henry II. He was a polished gentleman, not particularly noted for his piety, but not very worldly either. He was able to lead a decent life despite his high office in the kingdom. But in those days, there was another important office, even more important than being chancellor, and that was being Archbishop of Canterbury, the most important church office in England. And when that office came vacant, the king decided to appoint his trusted friend and chancellor, Thomas Becket, to that post. The problem was that Becket was not even a priest. He had not been ordained as a priest. He had not been interested in a clerical life. He was quite happy serving in the state. But Henry was so concerned to get his man in that position that he appointed Becket. That happened from time to time in the Middle Ages. It's called lay investiture. That is, rather than the church, namely the pope, appointing someone like the archbishop, the king would. The king is a layman. And he makes the appointment here, despite the fact that the church claimed that only the church could appoint an archbishop. But the king did it anyway, and created a problem. In fact, lay investiture had been a practice in England for a long time, and the strong kings in England, in France, and elsewhere would try to get their own people into these high clerical offices, because if they were really going to control the kingdom, they had to control these offices. You see, issues like this would arise when the king wanted to raise taxes. He would levy taxes to raise money. And sometimes he would tax the clergy. The pope said, you can't tax the clergy. Only the church can tax the clergy. And so there would be a conflict between the king and the pope over an issue like this. And the king wanted to have a sympathizer in an office like the Archbishop of Canterbury in order to be able to further his program in England. And so he appointed Thomas Becket, thinking that Thomas would serve him as Archbishop just as he had served him as Chancellor. But something happened when Thomas became Archbishop. He took it seriously as a church office and not an office of the state. In fact, Thomas went to Rome and resign as Archbishop of Canterbury so that he could receive that office back from the Pope's hands, hands holier than the King's hands. And you can see now the scene set for a clash between these two friends, because Thomas, who appeared to be the man that would do the King's bidding in the highest clerical office in England, turns out to be not the King's man, but the Pope's man. Why that happened, we don't really know. Why Thomas Becket made that dramatic and sudden change, King Henry could never figure it out either. He felt that Thomas had let him down. And he kept hoping that Thomas would come to his senses and come back to his side. But Thomas Becket never did. And the scene was set for a clash between the archbishop and the king, between the hammer and the anvil. That's the title I used for this lecture, and it comes from the play by T.S. Eliot called Murder in the Cathedral, which is the story of Henry II and Thomas Becket. One writer on English church history put it this way: Becket was determined to be as magnificently the hero archbishop as he had been the hero chancellor. Well, maybe that explains it. Maybe not. The only thing we know for sure is that for 8 years, Thomas Becket was a hero chancellor. And for 8 years, he was a hero archbishop. When he was chancellor, he did everything he could to promote the cause of Henry. And when he was archbishop, he did everything he could to oppose the policies of Henry that he felt conflicted with the interest of the church. The result, of course, you know from reading Gonzales, and probably know this anyway because it's a famous moment in history. In the year 1170, Thomas Becket was murdered in the Canterbury Cathedral. He had been in England for some time. He had been in France for some time. He left England in order to escape the wrath of the king, but then felt at last he should return to England to fill the office that he served as archbishop. And he was murdered in the cathedral by four zealous knights of Henry II, who had overheard Henry say, "I wish somebody would get rid of that troublesome priest." Henry probably didn't mean it exactly like that. He did not think anybody would take him literally, although he should have known better because he was king. And the four knights rode to Canterbury and there confronted Thomas Becket right in the cathedral. T.S. Eliot wrote the play Murder in the Cathedral was first performed at Canterbury Cathedral in 1935. I saw it performed at Graham Chapel at Washington University in 1988. That was the 100th anniversary of the birth of T.S. Eliot in St. Louis, as you may know. St. Louis honored Eliot, although Eliot didn't particularly care for St. Louis and left as soon as he could and moved to England, became an English subject. But nonetheless, we honored T.S. Eliot, and the play Murder in the Cathedral was performed in Graham Chapel, which is not a cathedral, but it looks like a little cathedral, has a medieval look to it, a very beautiful chapel on the campus of Washington University. And it was very interesting to go to Eliot's play performed in the chapel because the action took place all over the place, in the balcony, in the back, outside, in the front, and of course the people were sitting in the middle We kind of followed the actions. People ran in and out of the church, and it produced an exciting evening for us all. And it is a very great piece of work, one of the finest statements of the Christian faith from the pen of T.S. Eliot. I would recommend that you read Murder in the Cathedral at some time. When Thomas goes to the cathedral and the priests are there, they know the enemies are coming. They know that there is danger. And the priest and Thomas go into the interior of the cathedral. And the priests say, in the words of Eliot in the play, "Bar the door, bar the door. The door is barred. We are safe, we are safe. They dare not break in, they cannot break in. They have not the force. We are safe, we are safe." Something like this did seem to happen as the priests locked the doors of that great church. It's not the same cathedral that is there now at Canterbury, but one that preceded the present cathedral at Canterbury. And they locked the doors, and they felt they could resist. But then Eliot has Thomas say this, and these are magnificent words, I think, that have more meaning than just for that moment in history in the year 1170. Thomas says, "Unbar the doors. Throw open the doors. I will not have the house of prayer, the church of Christ, the sanctuary, turned into a fortress. The church shall protect her own in her own way, not as oak and stone. Stone and oak decay. Give no stay, but the church shall endure. The church shall be open, even to our enemies. Open the door." That was a great speech. And the door was open. And the result was that the four knights came in and near the altar killed Thomas Becket. Well, we have the chancellor, the archbishop, and now the saint. Because it's not long, just 3 years after he was killed, that he was canonized, became Saint Thomas Becket. The king himself did penance. 3 days after he heard of the death of his former friend, Henry stayed in his room, fasting and weeping. It's hard to know what was going on in Henry's heart. Is there a genuine repentance here, or is there frustration, or exactly what is happening? But eventually, Henry went to Canterbury and stood before the shrine of Thomas Becket and did public penance. Now, Henry may genuinely have repented, but think of what's happening here. This is a conflict between the church and the state. And the church has some very strong weapons. I mean, the king can kill the archbishop if he wants to, but the church can retaliate, and Henry knew that the church could retaliate. Now, one way the church could retaliate was by excommunication. Henry could be excommunicated, which meant that he would be cut off from the sacraments of the church. And we saw in the last lecture how important the sacraments were for medieval Roman Catholics. But there was another weapon the church had, which was even more powerful, and that was the interdict. The Pope could not only excommunicate the king, but he could place the whole kingdom under an interdict, which meant that no services could be held, none of the sacraments could be performed, nothing could take place in the churches. The sacramental system would be stopped, and the whole kingdom would be shut off from the means of salvation for as long as it took. Well, when people really believed that that was happening, king would not dare risk an interdict because it would create a popular revolution that would make for great trouble in the kingdom. The interdict was used frequently in the Middle Ages, not only by popes for nations and bishops for smaller areas, but there are even frivolous uses of the interdict when a bishop, for instance, imposed an interdict on the people of a certain area in the Holy Roman Empire because they would not permit a monastery to have the exclusive right to make and sell beer in that area. People did not like the monastery's product and wanted to make their own, and the bishop then pronounced an interdict upon the people of that town. Well, it was a powerful weapon, even if it was frivolously used, because if you believe that salvation comes from the exercise of the sacraments, and those sacraments are cut off, then salvation is cut off. So, the king, Henry, may have been genuinely repentant, but he was also fearful, I'm sure, of the reprisals of the Pope, because Thomas immediately became a hero, a martyr, hero, saint, canonized in the year 1173, and he became a popular figure in the religious piety of the people of England. We're talking in the last lecture about the importance of pilgrimages, and in England, after 1173, the place to go was Canterbury. In fact, there was the Pilgrim's Way through the south of England. Occasionally, people still walk the Pilgrim's Way to go to Canterbury. And pilgrims went to Canterbury in order to visit the shrine and tomb of Thomas Becket. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is the story of a group of pilgrims on the Pilgrim's Way going to Canterbury and spending the time entertaining themselves by telling different stories as they go. I think two of the reasons why Thomas Becket became such a hero to the English people, kind of Christian hero, was first, that he did not resist. Now, he was not a saint before he died, in one sense of the word. He could be a very sharp-tongued person, had his animosities and his bitterness. But at the last moment, he did not resist, you know. Throw open the door. Christ's church should be open even to its enemies. And people remembered that. Secondly, when he died, it was discovered that under his robe, he wore a hair shirt. Now, that was a particular kind of garment that some particularly pious people would wear in the Middle Ages just to become more uncomfortable. It apparently was a very uncomfortable thing. You know, it scratched and it was not something you'd want to wear next to your skin. But in order to afflict the flesh and suffer somewhat, some people wore hair shirts. And when it was discovered that the Archbishop of Canterbury did that, it was then viewed that he was a particularly holy man. Stephen Langton, whose prayer we used to begin the class, became a later archbishop and promoted the jubilee of Becket's death so that the shrine of Thomas Becket became very central, as I have said, in the piety of the people of England. Well, that's a famous story, and it illustrates the point of this lecture. That is, will the king dominate the church? or can the church dominate the king? Let's move on to 1294. Thomas Becket died in 1170. 1294, 80-year-old man became pope. He took the name Boniface VIII. He reigned until 1303. Someone has written of him, he came in like a fox, he reigned like a king, and he died like a dog. Well, perhaps not a very complimentary or kind sentence to utter about Boniface VIII, but it does touch on some elements of his life. Boniface had his battle too, not with the King of England, but with the King of France. Boniface struggled with Philip IV of France. Some of the same issues that we talked about earlier in England, taxation of the clergy, the appointment of people to clerical offices, it's called Unum Sanctum Ecclesiam, one holy church. And it's a kind of classical formulation of the papal claim to supremacy of the preceding centuries as well as of the following centuries. It sums up this view that under God there is the Pope and then the King and then the people. It's sometimes described as the two swords. Boniface and popes before him and popes after him would talk about the two swords. The church had one sword and the state had one sword. But the church had the superior sword. The sword of the church was superior to the sword of the state. The bull, One Holy Church, says, since spiritual power exceeds the temporal in honor, spiritual power is greater than temporal power, it may be used against the temporal, and it must be used if the temporal is in error. So if there is an error in the state, the king does something wrong, then spiritual power is above temporal power and must correct the temporal power. If the spiritual power errs, he or it will be judged by the supreme power, who is the Pope. If there is a mistake, an error on the spiritual side at some lower level, then the Pope judges that. If the supreme power errs, that is the Pope, he can only be judged by God. He is responsible to no one but God, as illustrated in the chart there. Now, all of that was not new, but Boniface states it with great force and then adds something that is new, and that is that salvation requires subjection to the papacy. The church had said for a long, long time that there can be no salvation outside the church, but now this pope is saying there could be no salvation without subjection to the papacy. Well, it sounds strong, and it was strong, but it was a bit hollow, because by the time Boniface writes these famous words, the Pope is not in much of a position to enforce them, because a new phenomenon has arisen in Europe. We haven't talked about this yet, but eventually we will. We could describe it as nationalism. People are beginning to think of themselves now as English, French, Spanish, not just as part of the church. And nationalism is going to favor the king and not the pope. So when Boniface VIII tries to suppress Philip IV of France by this bull and by threats of excommunication and the interdict, but with nationalism on the rise, those threats are not as strong as they had been in the past. Philip simply responded by encouraging Italian and French nobility to raise an army and go down to Rome and deal with the Pope. The Pope was attacked by this coalition, made a prisoner, and quite soon died in humiliation. Then begins a long line of popes, I think seven of them, who don't live in Rome, but live in France. France takes over the papacy and moves the location of the head of the church from Rome, where it had been for centuries, to southern France, to the town of Avignon. This is called the Babylonian captivity of the church. Seven popes lived in Avignon for about 70 years. That's why it's called the Babylonian captivity of the church, because for about 70 years, the papacy was captured, so to speak, by the French kings. Seven popes, French colleges of cardinals, the papacy really becomes French at this point. And sinners in unmistakable extravagance in Avignon, until finally Gregory the 11th, the last of the Avignon popes, reluctantly returned the papacy to Rome, and then promptly died, which created an even bigger problem. Because he goes back to Rome and dies, the College of Cardinals meets, and under pressure from the Roman people, who want a pope in Rome again, they elect an Italian to serve as pope. But then as soon as most of these cardinals got out of town, they were sorry about what they did, and they annulled that election and elected someone else as pope. But that meant that there were two popes. The pope in Rome stayed in Rome. The other pope went back to Avignon. And now there are two popes, what we call the Great Schism, in the history of the church from 1378 to 1417. Now, with all these problems, and these are huge problems, there are people beginning to think that the church is not organized correctly. Something is wrong. One of the people who came up with a new idea as to how church and state should be organized is the famous poet of Florence, Dante. He wrote not only the Divine Comedy, but he wrote on monarchy. In which he set forth ideas that we could diagram this way. Neither the Pope nor the King is head of the other, but both are responsible to God. Under God, there is the Pope, who is over the people as far as the church is concerned, and under God, there is the King, who is over the people as far as the state is concerned. Well, that's a much more modern view. And Dante felt that it was necessary for the papacy to surrender its temporal claims. This would mean the papacy would become now just a church. In the view of the popes, the papacy was both a state and a church. with its own tax, its own armies, its own ambassadors, just like any other state. But Dante says the church should be a church and the state should be the state. Both are responsible to God and to God alone. You might know, if you've read the Divine Comedy, this scene. I don't know how many people read the Divine Comedy anymore, but certainly worth reading, especially in the Dorothy Sayers translation, and especially for her footnotes. You can read through the Divine Comedy, and you need the footnotes because there are a lot of names, and it's difficult without the footnotes, but Sayers' footnotes are a wonderful way to become at home in the political and ecclesiastical world of the Middle Ages. There have been more recent translations of the Divine Comedy, but I don't think any are superior to Dorothy Sayers, and nobody has come close to her notes in setting forth the theological significance of what Dante writes about. But in the 19th canto of Inferno, Hell, Dante and his guide find the popes. Now, here's a medieval Italian scholar and poet who's writing about hell, and he's putting the popes in hell. And these popes are in hell in unusual circumstances. One was head down in a crack in the earth with his legs pointed upward. And they see this person with his head in this crack in the ground. And someone asks, "O wretched soul, whoso thou art that keepest upside down, planted like a stake, say a word if thou canst. Who are you there with your head in the ground like a tree or a stake?" And he cried out, "Art thou already standing there, Boniface?" Now, Boniface was the pope I was just talking about, who produced the bull One Holy Church. And what Dante is saying here is that the next pope would come and press the earlier pope on down through that fissure, totally into hell. And then another pope would do the same thing for that pope. This was the way a pope was being punished. He was waiting, and his successor, Boniface the Eighth, would push him more deeply into hell. Now, that's pretty striking. That's pretty strong. And remember, that's not Luther or Calvin or John Knox. That's a medieval Catholic poet, Dante, describing the popes that way. There was another Italian. Dante was from Florence. Marsilio was from Padua. Later became rector of the University of Paris and wrote a book called Defender of the Peace. Even more radical than Dante's view, because Marsilio of Padua said that people should begin to think this way. There is God. God never changes. He's always up here. But look what's happened to the people. They've always been on the bottom before, and now they're right under God. So God gives authority to the people, who through an assembly can elect the king, and through a council can set forth its will for the pope. God, working through the people, in the state, and in the church, through an assembly and through a council, to direct the officer of the assembly and the people, who is the king, and the officer of the council in the church, who is the pope. Well, understandably, neither kings nor popes cared for Marsilio of Padua's book. One of the popes said it was the most heretical book he had ever read, and you can see why. Well, that's an amazingly modern view, and it doesn't get out of the abstract area in the Middle Ages. Later, in modern times, it will become much more significant as actual practice, but new ideas are occurring, and people are trying to determine how to solve the great problem that the church had gotten itself into. One of the ways in which the church tried to solve the problem was through conciliarism, or through the idea of the council. Perhaps a council can meet. If the popes can't solve the problem of the church, then a council could meet and solve the problems of the church. The problem was that one pope would excommunicate the other pope and then place under interdict all the people that were following that pope, which meant eventually everybody in Christendom was excommunicated. Here's a map that shows how the Great Schism worked out. If you have two popes, then you've got to decide which one to go with. And in blue here, you have land giving allegiance to Avignon. You would expect France to do that. Also parts of Spain, Kingdom of Naples, and Scotland way up here, because Scotland was linked with France in the old alliance, and England was going to go the other way, and whatever England did, Scotland did the opposite. Land giving allegiance to Rome, and part of Italy, Eastern Europe, Scandinavia. And then the Holy Roman Empire and Portugal just could not make up their minds which way to go. It was an important decision. If you chose the wrong pope, then you got an invalid sacramental system, because the system depended upon the pope being the right pope and being able to guarantee the efficacy of all the sacraments. We must attempt to imagine what it meant for people at that time. It seems ludicrous to us in some ways, certainly unfortunate, but it was a tragedy for the people in Europe, for Christianity, and for people that were taking the church seriously. The idea was to bring in a council now. If the popes cannot get it right, perhaps a council can. And so a council was called at Pisa in Italy, and elected a new pope, deposing both the Roman pope and the Avignon pope. But neither of those popes was impressed with the decision of the Council of Pisa, and rather than ending up with one pope, they made the situation worse by not resigning, and the church now is divided among three popes. The Pisan pope, Alexander V, soon died and was succeeded by John the 23rd. John the 23rd is a very interesting character. Not an incompetent man, although he had a reputation that he brought with him to the papacy. He had been a soldier. That was the polite way to put it. He really had been a pirate. And he ruled then as the third pope, John the 23rd. You might recall that Giuseppe Roncalli, when he became pope in 1958, beloved pope, took the name John the 23rd. So for almost 500 years, no pope had used the name John, up until the second Pisan pope. There had been 22 popes named John, because John is such a beloved name in Christian history, but no pope dared risk the name John after John the 23rd. And there's a second John the 23rd because the first John the 23rd is not considered a true pope by the Catholic Church today because he was a Pisan pope and not a Roman pope. I think when John the 23rd, the modern John the 23rd, took that title, it said something to people that his pontificate was going to be somewhat unusual because he dared risk taking a name that was honored but dishonored, and his short reign of 5 years was very unusual because Vatican II was called during that time with all the changes that it brought to the Catholic Church. But to go back to this period, now three popes. People talked about the cursed Trinity rather than the blessed Trinity because there were three popes, Avignon, Pisa, and Rome. Finally, another council was called, the Council of Constance, one of the most important councils of the late Middle Ages. It met for 4 years, over 4 years. And this council did a number of things. We'll see later something else that it did. But the main point that I want to make now is that in the Council of Constance, conciliarism triumphed. The council was able to force all three popes to resign. And to establish the idea that the church now would be ruled by a council, not by a pope. You can read in the syllabus the heart of the statement of the Council of Constance, which says that the Roman Catholic Church is a conciliar church governed by a council, and the council would meet periodically in order to govern the church. Well, it started off well, but the new pope, Martin V, elected at Constance, almost immediately prohibited appeal from a pope to any other court. And before too many years, Pope Pius II prohibited any and all appeals to a council over a pope. You might say when the popes were weak and divided, the council was strong. But when there's one single pope again, the council becomes divided and weak. And the papacy is able to reestablish its supremacy in the Roman Catholic Church, which has continued down to the present. There was the Council of Trent in the 16th century, but that had to be ratified by the pope before any decision could be accepted. There was Vatican I in the 19th century, which set forth the dogma of papal infallibility. And once that is clearly in place, then what's the role of a council if the pope is infallible when he speaks ex cathedra? There was Vatican II in the 1960s, but Vatican II was clearly a council called to advise the pope and had no independent authority. I think even though conciliarism failed in the Catholic Church, it was not without effect. We're close to the Protestant Reformation, and the Protestant churches are going to organize themselves quite differently from the Catholic Church. Conciliarism viewed the church as a community of believers. It set forth some sort of idea of representative church government, and it stressed the importance of lay people, community of believers, representative church government, the importance of the laity. And even though those ideas failed in the Catholic Church, the conciliar ideas would prevail in different forms in the Protestant churches of the 16th century. Grass withers, flower falls, but the word of our God will endure forever.